Precinct Podcast, side podcast. I have a guest with me to talk about something that is linked in the most tenuous way to the works of Ed McBain, and that is an episode of Star Trek from 1968 called Assignment Earth. So, I have got with me an old colleague, a very good friend, Mr. Adam Paxman. Hello, Mr. Adam Paxman.
Hello, Paul.
Would you describe yourself as an artist, Adam?
Illustrator, Paul.
Illustrator. Okay. What's the difference?
That would be another side. That would be a side podcast.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So we'll leave that then.
Yeah.
Well, if you're interested in seeing some of Adam's illustrations, he has three particular strands of... they're not narrative necessarily, all of them, are they? But you've got Mr. Paxman's Glorious Bastards. What's that about?
That is about a parallel universe full of the scum of the earth, the most wretched human beings imaginable.
Excellent. We have the Museum of Fragmented Shadows.
Which is a Victorian, absurd, humorous monster science installment, also set in that parallel universe, but set in the Victorian period predominantly.
And my personal favourite, we have Burning Zebra, the abandoned storybook.
Yes, anthropomorphic characters running about answering the big questions of life, the universe and everything to
sort of... Have they actually answered any questions yet?
Yeah, maybe. Possibly. Maybe not. Are there any answers out there?
Are there any answers?
We'll find out.
Beyond me, mush.
Read and enjoy.
Okay, so all of those blog-type websites are online, aren't they, if you just search for the names of them, and I'll put a link in the description for the podcast. But I've invited you on here for a very specific purpose, because you are, amongst the humans I know, one of the nerdiest of sci-fi fans. And when I decided I was going to look at this episode of Star Trek from 1968, as I mentioned before, you were the person that came to mind, as I knew you would, A, know about the episode already, and B, be willing to put in the groundwork to really help illustrate this. Illustrate it.
Oh, see? Yes.
There so we go.
That was clever, wasn't it? I was aware of Assignment Earth before you messaged me about it, and I'm very happy to talk about Assignment Earth as a Star Trek fan. And also, I do know a little bit about some of the spin-offs, and I've also freshened up my memory of things of this type by doing a little bit of research, making some notes. I don't know if you can hear me turning my
That's the sound of notes.
Pages of research notes. Yes, on Gary Seven and his wacky adventures.
Well, I'll just outline the connections. I think I have mentioned this before on the podcast we did for Killer's Payoff, which was a few books ago in terms of our regular podcast. The link to Ed McBain here is that the main character in this episode of Star Trek is played by Robert Lansing, who plays Steve Carella in the TV series 87th Precinct, which was in 1961-62. Fairly short-lived, really, only a small run of episodes. He is in this episode of Star Trek, which has a strange distinction of standing out on its own compared to many of them, I think, and could have been a whole new direction for sci-fi in the late 60s. So that's how we've got to this point and why we're doing the podcast. So, Assignment Earth, Star Trek Season 2, yeah, last episode.
Final episode, that's right, yeah. It would have been the final episode of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Except the letter-writing campaign by two fans in the late 60s revived the show for the third season. Gene Roddenberry was still involved in the third season, but far less so. And he was obviously already trying to get other pilots produced. And one of those was the show that this episode, Assignment Earth, would have been a backdoor pilot for. So there is swimming around online, there is an original script for Assignment Earth as a show, as a pilot. Then there is a version of it, which is a Star Trek Assignment Earth episode.
Yeah.
And I think when you watch the episode, as you say, it's it does feel unusual as a Star Trek show, because Kirk and Spock and the rest of the Enterprise crew are very much sidelined for a majority of the episode.
They certainly are. I think it's a fantastic episode for various reasons. I'm not entirely sure how well it's thought of in terms of actual Trek fandom. It clearly captures the imagination of some fans who love it very, very much, enough to go and make a fantastic website dedicated to this single episode. If you want any of the resources to do with this episode, assignmentearth.ca is a website just about this. It's got everything on there you could possibly want. It's a researcher's dream.
Yes, I did look at that extensively this morning. Well, as extensively as one can in a morning, in preparation for this podcast. It really is very thorough. But also just YouTubing Gary Seven and Assignment Earth, I came across a fan film.
A
fan film of Assignment Earth, which
starts... There's quite a lot of fan-made stuff to do with Star Trek, isn't there? There's something called Star Trek Continues.
Yes, which is...
I've never seen, but it's quite a good cast in it.
Ironically, ending soon. The penultimate episode just came out a week or two ago. Because they I think partly because they've tightened up the rules, the laws... to do with
derivative works.
And how fair use is used. Obviously, the Axanar legal debate went on. Well, it's still going on, I think, last year and into this year. Yeah, so I don't know.
So there's a Gary Seven.
There is a Gary Seven. There's an Assignment Earth.
We keep saying Gary Seven, like everyone knows who we're talking about.
Robert
Lansing's character in this is called Gary Seven.
Mr. Seven. He's credited on screen as Mr. Seven, but then no one ever refers to him as that. He's called Gary Seven from the very beginning, yeah.
So what I was thinking is, when he gets beamed aboard the Enterprise at the start of the episode and introduces himself as Gary Seven, no one blinks an eye that his surname is Seven, the word, not the number. He doesn't say, I am Unit 7 or Inspector Number 7 or whatever it is. He says Gary 7. So do people actually have the surname 7 in the real world?
I think maybe with an R in it, like the River 7, but it's
Kenny 7.
I can't think of
Sandra
any...
Sandra 7.
I mean, 7 of 9, but that was her...
Those were numbers.
That was her Christian name with, you know, the Christian Borg. that was a designation.
Like a tennis player.
Yes, yeah.
But yeah, it's called Gary Seven, which it's a great name. It captures the imagination, but it must be a code name, surely, because he's...
Yeah, one would assume so. Or, I mean, there's a lot of backstory that's alluded to. I'm going to say alluded to, but the episode is stuffed full of exposition. But it's really weirdly mysterious exposition, which would have presumably been fleshed out in the show if it had been picked up. So there's this whole thing about Gary Seven's parents were taken 6,000 years ago to a hidden planet that's still hidden in the 23rd century of Kirk, Spock and so on. And Gary Seven has been bred, especially as like a perfect specimen of a human, to then be an agent for this advanced alien race.
It seems to me, and I made a note here, that the aliens' plan, which is to take people away and train them for generations.
Yes.
If they can take them away.
Yes.
If they can beam them across thousands of light years.
Yes.
Why?
Yeah, I don't really see the point of any of it. According to information on the website you quoted before, Roddenberry had spoken to futurists about different ideas, and several of the futurists said that this would be a way that an advanced species might infiltrate or try to guide human development, perhaps positively. I don't know if you want to get into like the Prime Directive. I don't know how much casual... podcast viewers, listeners would know about the Prime Directive. So General Order 1 in Starfleet or the Federation is to not interfere with pre-warp civilizations. So this advanced alien race clearly doesn't have its own version of the Prime Directive, because Gary Seven's mission in the episode is to stop a suborbital nuclear platform from being deployed, which will bring about, well, will precipitate a situation in which World War III happens. Yeah. So Gary Seven is very much a good guy in this episode. But interesting.
We don't know that.
The whole sort of drama of the piece comes from, can Captain Kirk trust Gary Seven? Is he really operating with the best wishes, the best intentions for human beings or not? And that's really the crux of it. Can he be trusted?
Yeah.
It runs basically for 50 minutes.
Well, one thing we should mention is, of course, it's a time travel episode.
Yeah.
And in the first 5 seconds, they basically go, we've travelled back to the 20th century because we just do it casually.
Yeah, that's right. It isn't a routine thing in any other Star Trek
episode. But in this one, it is. We've just used the technology.
Yeah, we've used the faster-than-light breakaway factor, which they only ever use, I think, I might be wrong, but they only ever use on screen once again in Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, when they're on in a Klingon craft, and it's the one with the whales that even people who don't watch Star Trek know, the one with the whales. Not the Welsh. They save the Welsh.
Yeah.
It would be a very different...
with reinforced glass.
Although it is...
cases.
It does sound like more of a comedic setup. Maybe less of a conservational theme. This breakaway factor and it being used purely for historical research. So the crew of the Enterprise going back in time to observe a critical point in history.
Yeah.
And it's that, as you say, it's not something that they've ever
It's just dealt within like one line at the start of it.
It's there because it's a setup to an episode. This is what always intrigues me when Star Trek fans online pick apart the minutiae of Star Trek episodes and say things about the new show, Discovery and stuff. A lot of stuff in the original series just, you know, is referred to in different ways or in ways that's essentially just for drama.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then people spend decades trying to retroactively fit it
into a unified
technology or a unified philosophy or whatever, when it's never really intended to be that way.
That's right.
But anyway, they're back on Earth in 1968. And what terrifies me is the situation they find themselves in is that the planet is apparently in 1968, which is when the episode was made and shown.
Yes.
The planet is surrounded by suborbital nuclear warheads.
Yeah, now, which in itself is a little bit of science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it... hopefully, isn't.
Well, yeah, Reagan-era Star Wars platforms were, what, the 80s? Mid-80s, and obviously that hadn't happened yet. And we still don't, as far as we know, we don't have orbital
nuclear bombs
platforms.
So
an interesting mix of what was then extremely contemporary current setting for a Star Trek episode, but also there is a little bit of futurism or speculative fiction, even within the episode, and Spock even mentions the most significant events that will happen in the year, and this took place. It was filmed in early 68, so they couldn't obviously possibly know, but they mention some things that would likely obviously have happened in a very very vague way. So assassination is mentioned, and I think. Teddy Kennedy and Martin Luther King were both, I think, 68. Yeah. So it's quite prescient, but it also does that just mean that if, as a writer, you know, if you at that point with civil rights and so on, the tensions in America, it was maybe quite a sort of safe.
Well,
sort of guess,
I think
almost.
Even 5 years later, you've off the back of the JFK assassination. Mm. And the Cuban Missile Crisis occurring. This is all stuff that's in the air. And a lot of this is about the hippie viewpoint as well, to some extent, because the second main character in this is called Roberta Lincoln. Mm. And although she's doing the square job of being a typist in this random office that she doesn't really know why she's there, she's sort of the hippie voice, isn't she?
She is.
In this.
She is.
She's played by Terry Garr, who... clearly had a horrible time making this and has never spoken about it since. Gives it a brief mention in her autobiography. You know, looking fab gear in some 60s outfit. I think she's brilliant in this. that's one of the sad things, is that she had a horrible time making it and we don't really know why, but I think she's an excellent member of the cast, and the way she plays her character, who's just suddenly thrust into a world of beaming aliens and magical computers.
Yeah, there is a sort of charming innocence to the character and how she reacts to things like a typewriter that types, that's speech dictated, automated. She gets to, you know, big shout out, she gets to call Captain Kirk a big jerk. And she sums up that...
It's quite a big jerk all the time, isn't it?
She sums up the sort of hippie aspect that you mentioned. Like, she says, that's why we're kind of crazy and rebels. We want to know if we'll be alive at 30, you know? And so it is this kind of...
It's the nuclear fear, isn't it?
Difficult time, yeah, in Earth's history. But yeah, she's very charming in what's initially set up as in a really odd way. As you say, she's a secretary, but she doesn't know who she works for or why she's there. It's a bit strange.
Yeah, so we don't meet her though until Gary Seven's turned up on the Enterprise and they've accidentally intercepted a beam that's being shot at Earth to send him there, and he turns up with a cat. And the cat's called Isis.
The cat, yes, I knew this would come up. The cat is called Isis, so if it was an episode of Downton Abbey, the cat would have to be put down. But the cat is, I don't know how much of this is like I Dream of Jeannie or Bewitched, that kind of magical sitcom. There's a definite cheesiness to elements of this episode, although it's essentially a spy thriller episode. There's some comedy. Well,
let's deal with the comedy of the cat.
Yes,
because the cat sort of is there and about throughout the entire process. It's got a nice silver collar, jeweled collar on it.
Yes,
and it's always referred to as like Gary Seven always sort of says, "No, Isis, not now," warning it off. And then in the very last sequence, Isis turns into a woman.
Yeah, only Roberta Lincoln's character. Only Roberta Lincoln, the character, Terry Garr's character, actually seems to see Isis transform into
a beautiful woman.
Essentially Julie Newmar.
More or less.
Yeah, a Catwoman type of cat woman.
And then by the time everyone else looks around, she's turned back into a cat.
Back into a cat, yeah.
Like, that's just my cat.
Yeah, so there's a joke at the expense of Roberta Lincoln.
And you wonder if this has been... If this had been spun off into a proper series, whether that would have happened a lot more?
Yeah. Would they have spent a lot of time playing the are you a cat or are you not a cat comedy?
Perhaps it might have never been mentioned again.
Yeah,
Roberta Lincoln would have spent the entire time just thinking that
just
fucking cat,
having lost her mind. Yeah. She's just lost her mind in the backdoor pilot.
Yeah,
and then yeah, and apparently I mentioned Julie Newmar, but there's a reference to Gary Seven calling Isis Julie Newmar in one of the books, in one of the spin-off books. So that's a nice little trivia nugget that I looked up on the website.
Shall we go all true crime for a moment?
Okay.
Because people love true crime podcasts.
Okay.
And we've got a true crime angle here, haven't we?
We have. I've committed a crime. Can you solve it?
Yeah. I'm doing one now on this podcast. This podcast could end up feeling like a true crime, the level of detail we might get into. But the lady who plays the human version of Isis the cat...
Not the cat.
Not the cat. We don't know about the crimes that the cat may or may not have committed, and we can't comment on that. We'll wait for the files to be released next year. What about this actress?
Victoria Vetri. Yeah, it was troubling, and I wasn't sure whether you'd bring it up. I only found this out this morning.
We love true crime.
When I was reading about
many podcasts. But
she, in amongst being Playboy Playmate of the Year 1968, the year that this episode came out, she also apparently and allegedly, I suppose we must say, for probably legal reasons, allegedly killed her, murdered her husband. And is, as far as I'm aware, still incarcerated for that crime.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. You can.
Have I spoiled the true crime angle? Is that
no? That's exactly it. That's okay. About as much true crime as we need. So that's the cat business, which is just strange. And even when Gary Seven is up a gantry 300 foot up, sabotaging a rocket, the cat's there with him.
Yes, and apparently, according to an interview with Robert Lansing, a lot of the lines of dialogue dealing with the cat were ad-libbed. They had he claims there were three cats in filming, and one of them particularly liked him, so would climb on him, and he would just ad-lib lines. Imagine
true professional Robert Lansing.
There you go. Imagine a whole series of that.
I think never worked with children and animals.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's the one thing that they didn't have in this backdoor pilot is any horrible kids.
Yeah, that's true. So, we've got Gary Seven. He's been intercepted by the Enterprise. The Enterprise don't know what to do with him. They finally managed to get him into the brig, basically, behind one of those wibbly-wobbly force field screens.
That's right.
And McCoy is called to examine him. This is about the only thing he does in this episode.
Very small role,
Made a note here. Did you notice in the doctor's room, and I don't know about the various backdrops and prop dressing of the surgery.
I think I know what you're going to say.
He's got stuffed animals all up on shelves behind him.
He's a doctor. He's a man of science. He's bones.
He is bones.
He's bones. So he has bones and taxidermy.
It's like you're going to the doctor's surgery. It's like going to your doctor's because you've got a cold or you need to get a repeat prescription for something. And you go in and he's nailed a dead koala to the wall.
Yeah, for science.
Okay.
And the healing properties.
Fair enough. Well, yeah, I'm sure.
It's basically Norman Bates, isn't it? There's a Norman Bates in this. I've always sort of thought it was bones for bones. That was
for bones.
Yeah, bones for the character of bones. And then the other one, the other brilliant set dressing is for Spock. You don't see it in this episode, but whenever you see Spock's quarters, he has this this meditation statue that looks like a bear, but because of the way that the sets are lit, my friend and I, when we used to watch these back, we always used to call it Disco Bear. So it's
four to the floor. I'm referring to the four strong beats of the disco beat, with an emphasis on the first beat, very often simply to drive the rhythm along.
I see. That's I don't know.
Often with an offbeat, say, hi-hat to give it a bit of kick. Anyway, let's not talk about that. Disco Bear. I like that. Well, let's stick with Spock, though. Okay. I know we're jumping around. It's very hard to do this in a linear way because there's so much to talk about. But let's stick with Spock. And Spock has to be beamed down to Earth in 1968. How does he disguise himself? Well, he puts on a suit.
He puts on a suit and a hat.
He has two amazing hats in this episode.
Does he have? Oh, I didn't notice the suit. There's a beanie hat.
Well, it's not a...
Well, not a beanie hat.
Russian fur trapper's hat, the first one he wears.
Is it? Yeah. Oh, I didn't notice that.
Or an advanced tea cosy.
Yeah, a standard...
Standard issue cat. Starfleet tea cosy.
Yeah. I didn't notice that. Maybe it was a tribble.
Possibly. It wasn't far off.
Spot.
And the second one is, when they go down again later to the rocket base, he's wearing like a fisherman's hat.
That's the one I'm thinking of.
Like a floppy rim.
Oh.
Fisherman's hat.
Focusing on Spock's hat.
Remastered version where they've CGI'd in new hats.
Yeah, just like one. I think more for like continuity purposes, they just maybe just put a different hat on him. When you're saying about Spock's in disguise, which they did even
a few times, haven't they?
Yeah, there's a couple of episodes I think even in that season where they went to more or less contemporary Earth because budget. Roberta Lincoln at one point pulls his hat off.
Pulls his hat off?
Pulls his hat
You've
off.
You've gone very Yorkshire
she
there,
pulls, She pulls his hat off and sees that he is a Vulcan.
Yes, and yet he never Vulcan nerve pinches her, does he?
No, but he does try, again, non-linear, he does try to nerve pinch Gary Seven at the start of the episode, and it doesn't work. It's only Kirk firing a phaser that stops him. Yes.
While we're talking about weaponry and devices,
yes,
let's talk about the fact that this is 1968. I'm going to drag this back to the UK. Doctor Who.
I know exactly what you're going to say. Yes.
Now, you and I are both big Doctor Who fans as well.
Yes.
By 1968, the sonic screwdriver has appeared a couple of times with Patrick Troughton.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it would go on to be a major part of
more and more
the stories until Peter Davison loses it and it comes back and all this, that and the other. Gary Seven has a super advanced magic ballpoint pen.
Yeah.
With little things that come out of it.
I've called it in my notes the Bliss Ray.
Well, it shoots a Bliss Ray amongst other things, doesn't it?
He does use it like a sonic screwdriver to open doors and various. It's got functions, many, many functions.
It does have a name, and I haven't written it down.
It starts with an S. It's a something. It's just like a. Sounds quite a functional name.
But his main way he uses it is he uses it to neutralize the prison force field to start with.
He does, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay, he gets out of his pocket. No one's searched him. They've put him in the brig. They've not actually checked to see where he's carrying
Again,
anything.
This is why red shirts are the lowest paid members of the...
And the first person that he... the guard, the red shirt guard who's guarding him, looks like a short Chris Hemsworth.
That's... Yeah, okay, yeah, I get that, yeah.
And Gary Seven gets out of his cell, zaps short Chris Hemsworth with the magical ballpoint pen.
Yes.
The... results of this ray, which you called the Bliss Ray.
I call it Bliss Ray.
I just said he collapses into an orgasmic collapse.
Yeah, that's a dirtier way of looking at it. But we do see the effect a few times, and especially there's a particularly orgasmic look on the security guard at McKinley Air Force Base, who's a very stern-faced man who then suddenly, instantly becomes very, almost goofy.
I think they're possibly aiming to the idea that it's like makes you instantly like you've had too much to drink or something like that.
Yeah, there's an element
of joy on their faces.
Yeah, there's an element of open to suggestion as well, because he does kind of walk the guard over and tells him to sit down and go to sleep. It's like a hypnotic thing, hypnotic suggestion. Yeah.
So, yeah, whereas the sonic screwdriver was sort of put to uses such as occasionally using it to undo screws, but mainly to just do whatever the plot needed to get the character moving out of a locked room or this, that, and the other. The magical ballpoint pen has this power of instant satisfaction, shall we say. Yeah. Something that Doctor Who never used the sonic screwdriver for, to the best of my knowledge.
Yeah, that we know of. Yeah, so we've got Gary Seven. We've got he's Supervisor 194, code name Gary. So Gary Seven is established as a code name in the episode. So we don't know his real name or why he's called Gary Seven. Maybe it's just like a dynasty thing, because if he's on a planet and he's been bred selectively from limited stock,
possibly icky,
then they might just kept calling him Gary, because they might not have be very imaginative. So he's got a cat called Isis, which is also his partner, agent partner, not like his sexual partner.
I mean, I can understand.
We get that there is some tension between them, I think.
About sort of retroactively fitting things together. I mean, a cat, if you could disguise yourself as a cat, generally that's quite innocuous. People are well disposed by and large to cats. They're quite slinky, they can get into different spaces.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it would be weirder if he was walking around with a python.
Yeah, but there is a point where he materialises at McKinley Air Base holding a cat, and people walk past him, you know, like personnel there, security personnel, and I don't know if in the 60s people were just walking around with cats a lot, but I saw a woman walking a cat 2 weeks ago in Waterloo, in Merseyside Waterloo, and you know I did a double take. It's not that common still
to see people walking a cat. No,
in whatever year this is,
it's very rare. In fact,
yeah, it is, and so it's interesting that you know that I don't know what Roddenberry did with cats, what he thought of cats, but it seems like this idea of Gary Seven just walking around with a cat all the time. And presumably that would have happened more and more if a series had gone to...
If a cat turns into a lady, does it eat cat food only as a cat? Does it eat human food as a lady or as a cat?
Now, these are very interesting questions.
These are important points.
For any kind of anthropomorphic character. But yeah, she's... There's a lot of questions about Isis and there are no answers.
There's a quote that could be taken out of context and used in any news.
About the cat woman, not cat woman.
So yeah, but Gary Seven goes to this office where Terry Garr's character works with these two missing agents, who then, despite being super beings bred on this magical planet and sent there, have died in a car crash.
Yeah, and that...
Sort of the prosaic sort of end.
Yeah, and it's... I don't know, there's something quite... not nice about that, but I think it's quite interesting that these very advanced humans bred by aliens just come to a sticky end because of, you know, chance.
Day-to-day and random.
And
I think Robert Lansing does acknowledge it and sort of says... The character Gary Seven sort of says, "What a, you know, it's basically,
wah, wah.
It's basically what a way to go of all the things, you
yeah,
know,
yeah,
all
yeah,
this that
yeah.
we've set up, and the main thing that they have set up is a computer the size of a caravan,
yeah,
inside this office.
I wrote down
as a safe to start with.
Well, no, So the vault. So Gary Seven's apartment. We should mention
okay,
this.
Go
so
on.
Gary Seven's apartment is also his office.
Uh-huh.
So there's no bed in there that we see. What we see initially is there are two rooms. There's this secretary's bit with a desk with a little green cube on it that ties into the computer. And then there's another room which has his office, very tastefully appointed, very sort of contemporary at that point. But there is a bank vault door which seems to be used for beaming. So that's like his technology, his beaming technology. And then there's also a hidden computer called Beta 5. And I think I'm right in saying that Beta 5 was also voiced by Victoria Vetri, who was the Isis the Cat
right, okay.
in human form.
Well,
I think that's right. I'm not sure.
My note about the computer, other than it's being massive, is that when he first gets there, the computer doesn't recognise him. And so he has
to sort of do
a voice override.
Lots of exposition.
Yeah. And so... The excuse is, she says, explain your mission.
Mm.
The computer says, explain your mission. So he does. And the computer goes, incomplete, but sufficient.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's using judgment.
It's that's weird sort of like, yeah, you're still all right then.
Yeah, you just scrape by.
It's incomplete, but sufficient.
Yeah, but there is, I think I'd said this before, there's a lot of exposition in this episode, and that's one of the points where the computer provides some, he provides some, then, you know, every time a new character's introduced, there's more sort of quite heavy-handed, in some cases, exposition to put across, you know, who this character is. Because, on paper, as we say, it's a pretty weird, I don't know if it's high concept, but it's a pretty weird, wacky concept.
Doctor Who has a lot of influence on this episode.
Yeah.
Basically, what they're trying to do is set up a story where a mysterious, a mysterious traveller from another planet, albeit a human.
Mm-hmm. With a youthful sidekick.
With a youthful sidekick and...
And a device.
And a magical pocket device has to...
Do a thing.
Investigate, get involved in stories.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, by 1968, Doctor Who, I think, is probably... Started a little bit in America. So I don't think it kicked in really until the late 70s. But it was probably enough of a success as a story, as a concept, that was influential. And I'm sure we could never find any evidence to back this up. But the coincidences are too much here, I reckon. They should have got Ed McBain in to write it. Made it a bit grittier.
Yeah, the bank vault, for instance, is really incongruous. In the apartment setting, but then even as like a transporter, it's just a port. You don't need the bank vault there. It just seems like unnecessary set dressing. It's a funny one. And Beta 5, the computer, is sort of characterised as being this sort of snippy, superior female voice. So Gary Seven's surrounded by female cast members, which would be great if it passed the Bechdel test, which it doesn't.
Oh.
Because Isis the Cat in human form never speaks, and Beta 5, I don't think, ever speaks to Roberta, what's she called? Roberta Lincoln. Or they never have a conversation, anyway.
We don't get into the portrayal of women in early science fiction. That's a whole other series of podcasts, and we are probably not the right people to deal with that. There's a lot of reference to an other major power.
Yeah.
Which clearly just means Russia.
Well, yeah, it's Cold War era, isn't it? And well, we assume if we assume that the Star Trek universe is our universe, which obviously it isn't exactly because the eugenics wars and so on in the 90s. There's this whole thing about whether Roberta Lincoln will quit. She keeps trying to quit all the way through, and it's kind of played for laughs, and then she doesn't ultimately quit, and she ends up.
She doesn't really know why she's staying, though, but she sort of falls in with having tried to stop Gary Seven, thinking he's mysterious.
That's right.
She ends up falling in with him when he's threatened by, or seems to be threatened by, Spock and Kirk. Or the rest of the Star Trek crew have such a bad time in this episode. Well, probably a good time, because I bet they were getting paid for a whole episode, and then they only turned up for a day's filming, because, like, Uhuru has one line or something like that.
Yeah, and Scotty basically gets to stand next to some stock footage of from NASA.
Yes,
and keep turning a.
But relatively speaking, he has more to do than put together.
None of the Star Trek characters, I would say, in this episode, really has much agency in the plot. As a, you know, they ultimately it comes down to Kirk and Spock. Well, Kirk's kind of paralyzed at one point. He can't really act at all, and it does come down to Gary Seven saving the day, and whether Kirk and Spock can trust him. Yeah, I've just noticed as well. Just on one more on Roberta Lincoln. She thought the job that she thought she was doing was research for a new encyclopedia.
Oh yes,
yeah, that was a little bit of back. So she does have a little bit of backstory, but she mostly doesn't know who she is, where she's going, or really anything. Even though she's referred to as being. Having a high IQ despite some erratic behaviour. And actually, she's introduced in a classic kind of, oh, this is a clumsy female character kind of way, because she does that funny thing.
She's trying to get away with being late.
Yes, and she walks left and then right and then left and then right in front of another person, and they move right and then left and right and then left correspondingly. And I can't remember what that's called. There's a thing for it.
Dancing.
But yeah, so she's an odd character. She's probably the most ordinary character out of Gary Seven, the magic cat, and the secretary.
Human way in, isn't she?
Yeah, she is. And she, like you said, with the sort of analog of Doctor Who, she'd be the youthful voice of the youth.
But Beta 5, the computer, which she experiences in the form of, I'm assuming that the magical voice-activated typewriter is also part of Beta 5, as is the green cube on the desk.
Yeah, he ties the green cube in. He says, tie into computer.
Yeah.
So it must have some other function as well.
And it becomes like Alexa or a home.
Actually, that's a really good...
Except it looks much cooler than any of those things that actually exist now, because it's a cool-looking green cube.
It's like a mini Marvel Tesseract.
I prefer to think of it as a mini green Energon cube.
Yeah, there's a lot of energy cube things in sci-fi, aren't there, isn't there? And fantasy. Yeah. So there's a whole... I mentioned the Prime Directive earlier, non-interference. Prime Directive clearly broken at least once in this episode, probably more. That could be a whole drinking game. The Prime Directive is broken when two Earth policemen are beamed up with Kirk and Spock. And
my favourite line in the show happens at that point.
And what is that?
Well, when they come to on the transporter pad on the Enterprise, one of them goes, golly, and then they get transported away again.
Yeah, it's completely without any consequence at all. And I was thinking, well, if Assignment Earth or whatever it would have been called had gone to Ceres, would they have kept turning up and sort of seeing little Gary Seven things like weird sci-fi stuff?
Or they could have their own spin-off themselves.
Roddenberry was just setting up characters just to be able to spin them off in as many series as possible.
Who, after years of service, slowly collapse into a mental decline due to they see
one time they get beamed up and they just can't make sense of that.
Basically, just their therapy sessions for 16 episodes a season.
I'd watch that.
I know you would. You said Star Trek at the front of it.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, so the Prime Directive clearly broken then, because they get to see the inside of a 23rd century starship. Gary Seven basically has to sabotage a United States. I mean, in terms of patriotism in the US, that's quite a daring storyline for 1968. That Gary Seven, who's actually working for the...
The greater good,
yeah. So it's a classic kind of greater good story, actually. The greater good has to cause a rocket to malfunction so that it does not cause the Third World War.
I think it's sort of tipping point, isn't it? So if this rocket goes up and delivers its payload into the atmosphere of another nuclear bomb, then that's the tipping point where...
Like a point of no return,
exactly. So he needs to get it to blow up.
Yes.
But not let anyone think it was
and presumably
someone else
then,
doing it. Make people think it's a malfunction.
Know that it's a malfunction so that they say, oh, well, actually, hang on a minute. Yeah, it's best not to have loads of nuclear weapons in suborbit because that's really dangerous. which obviously...
Maybe we're going to send someone to space. We're going to be dodging nuclear missiles.
So obviously someone saw this episode and thought, hang on, they're onto something.
Clearly.
You know, we don't, do we? I've written in big letters here, Paul, man with cat absurdity. And obviously I mentioned I Dream of Jeannie and Bewitched before, but there is something very sort of 60s about this Gary Seven setup. And it almost, if you stripped the cat, not stripped the cat, but if you stripped the cat out of this story, it's a lot more streamlined.
Yes.
Immediately. But it seems like a really kind of goofy hook that would have been kind of, I don't know the air dates for Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie and those kind of magic shows.
Must
but
be fairly contemporary.
Yeah, I'm thinking that was kind of thrown in as a sort of nod to, oh, well, magic.
Yeah, magical character.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's interesting. But Robert Lansing himself as an actor, he's brilliant. I love him as Steve Carell, as listeners to this will know, in the 87th Precinct series. You've got a real... carries himself really well, and I've shown you an episode of the 87th
today,
Precinct.
And I really enjoyed it. Yeah,
it's very good. That's a very Carell
heavy
one.
What was that episode called?
It was called The Very Hard Sell.
The Very Hard
and
Sell,
and it featured a very young Leonard Nimoy.
It did.
As the villain of the piece.
Yes.
And no pointy ears and hats in that scenario, but a very nice skinny tie and a handy line.
I think
and
he did. He
around.
Wore a trilby at one point.
He did wear hats.
Yes.
Yeah, but he was pushing heroin for innocuous-looking grocers, apparently.
Yeah, health food shops have really come a long way.
Yeah, from selling steaks, cigarettes
and heroin. Yeah, not to be trusted.
But Robert Lansing, I think Robert Lansing has the gravitas to carry it off, but he's also got enough of a... I don't want to say a twinkle, because that's always a bit cheeky. It's what makes him sound a bit like a Patrick
Troughton. No, he plays it straight. I think he does play it straight.
He's got a very engaging presence on screen, and he would have been a great leading man.
Yeah.
And I think he was up for doing the series. He would have been quite happy for it to go to series.
Because apparently Roddenberry wrote it for him. They were friends. And he described himself in an interview as saying, oh, I was a slightly snobbish New York actor. And I'd just gone out to Hollywood to do a couple of things. But yeah, I mean, if you're going to do a backdoor pilot, it sounds as though he'd have returned for whatever the series would have been. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? If you think about that series, would it have been Assignment Earth and each episode would have been on Earth, or would Roddenberry have kind of pushed the format to being more of a Doctor Who, you know, open-ended thing? Because they did have this transporter, so they could do episodes set elsewhere.
But
in the Star Trek universe, essentially, but in the 20th century.
In Doctor Who, where they start to bring Doctor Who to Earth put him there as a way of grounding the stories. In the unit stuff with John Pertwee. Anyway, that's a whole other thing. We're not talking about that.
Something else.
Anyway, have you got any other major points to make here? I'd like to make the point that everyone should watch Assignment Earth and imagine their own spin-off series from it.
Yeah, I think there's an amazing bit where Scotty is basically used as a sat-nav. Because Kirk and Spock need to find Gary Seven's apartment and Scotty says it's like 30 metres. Yeah, it's where you are, but 30 metres up. So obviously it's in the building. And then he's even like room to room. He's pointing them in exactly the right direction. It's funny that there's a manhunt when they seem completely useless in this episode.
It's this thing from a modern perspective where now like having a map in your pocket down to, in fact, inside buildings in some cases, that level of detail, that for all the things they can imagine, the big stuff, the spaceships, the transporters, even the philosophies of the future, they don't often imagine the day-to-day things that we actually have ended up taking for granted, like having a sat-nav in our pocket on our phone, or, well, even a mobile phone. They've got the communicators, which is their equivalent.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange, because they could have just had like one scene where they work out to read, to look in like a Yellow Pages.
Yes, indeed. It is fascinating, and it is full of also lovely stock footage of NASA from the time as well.
It certainly is. If you're a fan of NASA stock footage, then this is for you.
Yes, certainly. There's lots of cutaways to control rooms and rockets, and they're matched by sets with gantries and things like that. So Gary Seven's up. I reckon it's probably a Saturn V rocket. I'm sure someone will tell me it's not. Which were the Saturn V's were the ones used to launch the Apollo missions.
So well, it'd be the same.
It'd have been up about 360 foot on that gantry doing that stuff. And there was no,
there was no crosswind.
There was no crosswind whatsoever, and the cat was there with him.
Yeah, there's a cat scratching his back. Yeah, so you asked me about one more thing. Columbo. Apparently,
there's going to be a Columbo side pod at some
there's
point.
In terms of spin-offs, I looked up, apparently there were some, there's been some DC... comic that's mentioned Gary Seven. IDW released a John Byrne Assignment Earth comic, and Greg Cox has also released three books featuring Gary Seven and the other characters from Assignment Earth. So Assignment Eternity, in which Gary Seven travels to the 23rd century and stops Spock from getting assassinated. So a little bit of almost a reversal of this plot in the sense that he travels. I mean, it doesn't expressly say that he can or can't time travel in Assignment
Earth. Well, given the Enterprise is hopping around like nobody's business.
If they're an advanced alien race, apparently time travel is quite easy. And then a two-part book, The Eugenics Wars, The Rise and Fall of Khan Noonien Singh. So that's Khan from The Wrath of Khan and Space Seed and more recently Star Trek Into Darkness. So yeah, so he has come back up in some of the like wider Star Trek media, but always as a apart from with the John Byrne stuff, where it's about Assignment Earth, everything else has always been like framed with a Star Trek backdrop framing device.
It's clearly caught people's imaginations, and I think that's in no part due to Robert Lansing's portrayal of Gary Seven, because he's such an interesting actor to watch.
Yeah, and I think interestingly, from my point of view, having seen this episode, and from my point of view, it's not one of my favourite Star Trek episodes. It's not something I've rewatched a lot because I find it kind of dull, slightly dull.
It's a weird way to end a series.
And it's a very weird way. If it had been the last episode, I think it would have been really like a strange episode to end with. But he's very good in it. And watching 68th Precinct...
87th Precinct.
Not 68th.
No, 68 was a year.
That was a spin-off.
Right. There was a 68th Precinct.
87th. Yeah, sorry, it was 1968. Sorry, yeah. 87th Precinct. The show, as an actor, you get his sense of kind of charisma, but for this kind of hard-boiled personality that he has. And you pointed out that whenever he's in disguise, he just smiles.
Yes,
because the rest of the time, he's very kind of rugged.
Goes off-grid just by smiling.
Yeah, he's stolid. Is that... Would that be...
Yeah, I'll go with that.
That's a good... he's not stoic, he's stolid.
No, I don't know that Corella's stoic ever as a character, particularly. Stoicism's more in the Maya line.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, what I'll do to conclude here is I'm going to ask you a couple of questions that you've not been given in advance.
Oh, wonderful. Amazing. Okay, shoot.
So these are McBain-based questions.
Oh,
and obviously,
no.
That's not general knowledge about McBain.
Okay.
Not,
well,
it would be specific knowledge,
wouldn't
it, about
McBain? I just got the name of the book series wrong.
Yeah,
so
that's tick. So McBain had a run of single-word book titles like Ice, Lightning and Bread.
Okay.
Very snappy titles.
Yeah.
Can you give me a single word off the top of your head that could be used as the title of a crime novel?
I know that Poison was one, so
it
does
was.
That count?
No, you can't have Poison because that is a one.
Oh, okay. Man, that's harder. You know, you always think that's so easy when you see...
Stop stalling.
I can't. I'm stalling for time. I'm just looking around the room now. Dartboard, is that one word or two?
Dartboard. Darts.
Darts. Dart.
Dart.
Single dart. Dart. Because that could mean running.
It could mean...
Darting from place to place.
The ability of McBain to layer up even a single word title is one of his skills, you see. So we can go with dart.
All I could see was Febreze.
Are you letting people know how bad my house smells now?
No, it smells good. It smells of Febreze.
That's the trick. Second question. Who are best, baddies or goodies?
Goodies.
Thank you, that's the right answer. That's not necessarily the right answer, but it's what I believe. And if you were a stool pigeon, what would your nickname be?
Speckles.
Speckles?
Mm.
And what would be your preferred place to meet?
A rooftop loft.
Like a pigeon loft?
Yeah, pigeon loft.
Okay. Is there many of them in Waterloo, Merseyside?
Yes.
Good.
Is that it?
That's it for the questions.
Okay. Is there anything else that we haven't covered?
Probably.
In terms of, like, we've talked about Lansing, So you said that the only real connection is Lansing.
Yeah, that's the only that's the only connection between the 87th Precinct slash Ed McBain and Star Trek that I can find, other than the fact that Leonard Nimoy was in an episode of the 87th Precinct TV series.
Yeah.
And it was an episode that McBain himself didn't write. It wasn't even based on one of the books. They're huge. Both things, the 87th Precinct, less thought of so much now, but that and Star Trek both had huge impact on the cultural landscape in terms of the types of things people made. So science fiction stories, police stories.
Mm. There's something quite archetypal, like just seeing that one episode, and I haven't read any of the Ed McBain books, but there's something quite archetypal about the police procedural setup of that show. And I said to you while we were watching it, you know, even Police Squad as a parody of that style, of that very sort of, not deadpan, delivery. It's just straight delivery, isn't it, if it's drama? But yeah, there's something quite archetypal about that, and I suppose there's something that's fairly archetypal in terms of sci-fi storytelling with Star Trek now.
Yes.
Especially when you consider things like the Orville, which are, you know, parodying the very sort of 90s 2000s versions of Star Trek, the later iterations. And you know, Star Trek wasn't the first thing to do it. It was things like Forbidden Planet and other movies. But it's had that sort of enduring appeal, hasn't it?
It's the serialised nature of it, I think.
Yeah.
The sort of almost short story aspect of an hour of television.
Yeah, and the simplicity, and then also later the, you know, complexity of the characters. But initially, there's such a simple setup with each character. They're so clearly defined. And I think that's something to be said for the what would be the Assignment Earth spin-off, is that we don't really get a sense of who Gary Seven is, other than he comes in and he does his job. We'd maybe get more backstory, you know, with this mysterious alien thing. We don't get a good sense of, like, who Isis the Cat, or Isis the human Catwoman, not Catwoman, is. And we also don't get a great sense of, like, who Roberta Lincoln is, beyond, like, slightly ditzy but highly intelligent, not got a lot of sort of clear drive in the episode. Yeah. So there's a lot of, I think what I'm trying to say is there's this weird sort of polar thing of the episode is deliberately mysterious, and or intriguing is a better word, deliberately intriguing, because they wanted obviously people to tune in when this show was made, and it obviously wasn't, but then also deliberately mysterious to give them some latitude to flesh it out. None of those characters necessarily have a very strong motivation other than the plot-based episodic nature of this particular adventure.
Okay, well, in conclusion then, how many Star Trek badges would you award it out of 100?
43.
43 out of 100.
Yeah, that's one more than the Douglas Adams Meaning of Life, isn't it? So 42. Yeah, so the it concludes with Spock and Kirk basically almost sort of nudge, wink, wink to camera saying, I think they've got a lot of interesting experiences in store for them. And Kirk saying, yeah, I think you're right. That sends them off on their adventures.
Although it does imply that they've looked into some data tracks and found out what their adventures are in the future.
Yeah, it does seem to imply that, yeah.
Clearly doesn't cover his tracks very well. There you go. Right, I think we're going to conclude there then.
You've got to data. You're going to be good with your data.
Mr. Adam Paxman, thank you for joining me.
Paul, it's been an absolute pleasure and a delight.
Good-o. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye. We'll be right back.